of worship led by the Reverend Christopher Lando. Now, Nancy Crane reads a final extract from Diane Hale's new book, Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. Lisa Gherardini, or the Mona Lisa, is about to marry the man who will eventually commission the world's most famous portrait.
For many a bride, then as now, the wedding, the single biggest event in the life of a Renaissance woman, was all about the dress. In a public display of family honor, a girl made the visual statement of her life. Regardless of strict sumptuary laws, universally disregarded by brides, no fabric could be too costly, no skirt too full or flowing, no flourish too flamboyant. One 13-year-old Florentine was so weighted down by her bridal attire that she could not move and had to be carried into the ceremony. Mona Lisa's dress would have been the most stylish she had ever worn, created with fabrics from the Del Giocondo workshops and sewn in the latest fashion. Atop her head, she may have worn a headdress, perhaps of feathers and pearls, held in place with finely crafted pins. In a ceremony called the Matrimonium, Lisa's relatives, friends, and her husband's kin would have gathered in her parents' home. They were asked a series of questions. First, their ages. Lisa, 15. Francesco, just shy of 30. A fairly typical difference for an upper-class union. Did each give free consent? Yes. Had they made prior commitments to another? No. Francesco pledged to take Lisa as his wife, to love her, honor her, keep her and protect her as a husband should his wife, and to keep from all other women except her as long as their lives should last. Lisa repeated the promises, but also vowed to obey and serve. In some ceremonies, the groom slid a ring onto the bride's finger. In one Ghirlandaio fresco, he does so with one hand while reaching for his promised dowry payment with the other. They were pronounced man and wife by a notary, and the guests would cheer and drink toasts to the newlyweds. This civil ceremony would be followed later with a priest's blessing in or on the steps of a church. Then came the triumphal procession from her parents to her husband's residence, a bride's moment of public glory. They rode side saddle through the streets on a decorated horse, at the head of a parade of family and merrymakers. I trace her possible route, picturing the shopkeepers calling out congratulations, children skipping alongside, old women waving from their windows. These days, when I encounter real-life brides in fluttery white dresses, posing for wedding pictures at various scenic spots around Florence, I imagine each feels as Lisa Gherardini may have, that for one shimmering moment, she has become the belle of the city. What happened next? I can imagine how overwhelmed and frightened a young girl like Lisa would have felt that night, alone with a much older man who had complete power over her. Not surprisingly, many a wedding night triggered what one scholar calls i crisi di pianto, attacks of crying, touchingly captured in a 15th century woodcut I found, in which a groom escorts the bride's friends out of the door as she lies weeping in their bed. The next day, newlywed Lisa awoke in a house filled with people she barely knew. Francesco's mother, his siblings and their spouses, and her 2-year-old stepson, Bartolomeo, plus numerous servants, maids, and cooks. Lisa had undoubtedly moved up in the world. Meanwhile, I can imagine her father walking through the streets of Florence, rubbing his hands together and reflecting what a coup he had pulled off. In exchange for a penniless daughter, Lisa's father had bagged one of matchmaking's biggest jackpots, a wealthy son-in-law. Perhaps a sly grin played on his lips, the telltale smile of a Gherardini. Although love was not considered a prerequisite for a successful Renaissance marriage, the merchant of Florence seems to have developed a genuine fondness for his spouse. He acquiesced to her every desire, loaning money to her father, building them a home of their own so she didn't have to live with her in-laws, and even providing for her impoverished siblings. In his will, he wrote touchingly of his lifelong affection for his noble-spirited wife. So how was Mona Lisa's sex life, I asked Professor Sara Grieco-Matthews, an expert on medieval and Renaissance sexuality, in her office at the Syracuse University in Florence campus. Probably not very exciting, she responds warmly, chuckling at the sheer incongruity of the question. Lise was married in order to pursue a procreational career. From 12 to 40, according to historians' calculations, a typical Florentine woman of the time became pregnant every 14 months. A bit of recreation might have snuck into these endeavors for some. The Duchess of Urbino, a woman of acknowledged refinement, burst into her niece's bedroom the morning after her wedding and trilled, "Isn't it a fine thing to sleep with the men?" Meanwhile, in Milan, these were tense years at the court of Ludovico Sforza. After initial support of the French king's incursion into Italy, the duke switched sides to support the Italian League, united to drive the French back out of Italy. In desperate need of weapons, he melted down the bronze intended for Leonardo da Vinci's great equestrian statue. "Of the horse, I say nothing," wrote a disappointed Leonardo, "because I know times are bad." Instead, the duke commissioned a special painting from him of Christ's last meal with his followers for the Dominican monastery where his father was buried. In this masterwork, Leonardo came closer than anyone ever to capturing the emotional subtleties he called the movements of the soul. As Lisa began bearing children to her new husband, history's kaleidoscope shifted again. The French king died, and his successor, Louis XII, marched French troops across the Alps, this time with Milan in his crosshairs. Leonardo headed out of town, first to Mantua, then Venice, and when he heard of his patron, the Duke Sforza's capture in Milan, he made his way back home to Florence. There was nowhere else to go. His father, Ser Piero, who for more than 20 years had lived near Lisa's grandparents in the city, might have watched Lisa grow from a darling child skipping down the block to an adolescent girl of striking beauty to a young matron with toddlers of her own. Ser Piero is most likely the one who presented her husband, Francesco del Giocondo, to his celebrity son, perhaps thinking of him as a potential patron. And so he was. The 16th century art historian Vasari, in the earliest account of the origins of La Gioconda, literally the Giocondo woman, provides only this minimal description. For Francesco del Giocondo, Leonardo undertook to paint a portrait of his wife, Mona Lisa. The arrangement would have made sense. Leonardo needed income. He had turned down other commissions he did not relish, and a brief stint as Cesare Borgia's military engineer had ended without payment, and the affluent merchant del Giocondo, who commissioned other works from well-regarded painters in this period, would have been proud to acquire a portrait by the acclaimed artist. If I could freeze frame one day in Lisa Gherardini's life, it would be her 24th birthday on June 15th, 1503. At this sweet moment in time, she would have every reason to smile. She had married into a secure and comfortable life. In the 8 years since her wedding, she had embraced a stepson as her own and given birth to 5 children. Her husband, who gifted her beautiful gowns and jewels, had purchased a new home for their growing family. And now this, an unexpected moment in the sun. Leonardo began working on his portrait of Lisa at this time. When she first met him, as a proper matron, she would have extended her hand for Leonardo to raise, almost, but not quite, to his lips. Even with her eyes cast demurely downward, she may have sensed the painter looking at her as no man ever had, studying the contours of her face as if breaking her bones and reassembling them in his mind. Leonardo's voice, reportedly so melodious that a sentence could sound like a song, would have soothed any nervousness. Bemused by the unlikely intersection of their lives, Lisa may have unconsciously let her lips curve into the slightest of smiles. As she dared to glance at him, Leonardo would have caught his first impression of her eyes, those mirrors of the soul. Something in their depths ensnared him, as the art critic Sir Kenneth Clark once observed. How else, he asked, could one explain the fact that while he was refusing commissions from popes, kings, and princesses, he spent his utmost skill painting the second wife of an obscure Florentine citizen? Maybe Lisa's obscurity was part of her appeal. Rather than mollifying a vain monarch by painting his mistress, Leonardo could bring to bear every technique he'd honed, every theory he had developed to capture una donna vera, a real woman, a fully dimensional human being, rather than anyone's pawn or fantasy. And perhaps with his discerning eye, Leonardo saw more than an ordinary young wife and mother caught up in the delights and distractions of small children and a blustering husband. Give your figures an attitude that reveals the thoughts they have in their mind, he advised young painters. Otherwise, your work will not deserve praise. Perhaps what intrigued Leonardo was Lisa's attitude, her own personal variant of Gherardininess, a spirit large-hearted enough to love another's child as her own, tender enough to tame a temperamental spouse, and determined enough, as she would prove in the decades ahead, to make wrenching choices, flinty enough to sustain her family through the dark years of upheaval that the future would bring. Beyond the girl that Lisa once was, Leonardo might have glimpsed the woman she was still in the process of becoming. Leonardo's entire career had led him to this point and this portrait. Through years of advanced mathematical calculations, he had worked out the perfect proportions for a human head. In experiments with optics, he had observed a pupil's response to the play of light and shadow. By dissecting cadavers, he had isolated the muscles that curve a finger or draw the lips into a smile. All that insight would sharpen his eye and guide his hand. In the process of creating the Mona Lisa, Leonardo would revolutionize art in never-before-seen ways. Using the so-called golden ratio, he would calculate the ideal distances between neck, eyes, forehead, and lips. He would highlight Lisa's supple hands like a work of nature and immerse objects in air and light so they appeared crisply defined in the foreground, but less so in the distance. And he would position La Donna Vera against a fantastical background in such a way that the coiling road, arched bridge, rocks, water, and mountains seemed as much a part of her as she is part of them. Like Prometheus, Leonardo would breathe life into his creation. The Mona Lisa would become una cosa viva, a living thing, almost human, yet at the same time something more elusive, poetry that is seen, which he called his ultimate goal. The portrait emerged face first. Lisa's smile may have been one of the first of her features that Leonardo drew, and according to later analysis, the last one that he touched when he was still revising it years later. Most Renaissance artists, whose attempts at grins ended up looking like grimaces, viewed the smile as an elusive holy grail, a consummate technical challenge. If you asked Leonardo what the smile meant, one historian comments to me, he would have said, "What are you talking about? Why are you asking? I was painting her face." I have no grand theory of my own, but the one I copied word for word in my notes comes from Oxford professor Martin Kemp, a preeminent Leonardo scholar. "No image," he observed, "has ever been more particular in the way it engages us with a specific human presence." Consciously or not, Leonardo created an exquisite prototype of a Rorschach test, an image that each of us can read in a unique way. We see in Lisa what we want to see: mother, lover, daughter, fantasy, soother, seductress. "What do you see when you look at the Mona Lisa?" my husband inquires. "A real woman," I reply. "Like you," he says. I open my mouth to protest, but then I realize that this may indeed be why her smile enchants, the sense that Lisa is somehow like us. In that face, in those eyes, and especially in that smile, we see a reflection of the secrets locked within our souls.
Nancy Crane was reading from Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered by Diane Hales. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It was a Brill production for BBC Radio 4.
I think life would have been very different. We'd have had a proper Labour government and life would have been very different indeed.
For BBC Radio 4, senior politicians reflect on their life and times. This week, Roy Hattersley.
Within the space of a year, we'd seen the trade unions behave hideously, and we'd seen public expenditure unsustainable. And to see those two pillars kicked away, that was very, very damaging, and I don't think the Labour Party has recovered from it now.
Reflections with Peter Hennessy. Next Wednesday at 9 o'clock in the morning, and again in the evening at 9:30.